Let's catch up now, as we occasionally do, on books we may have missed. Librarian Nancy Pearl stops by from time to time to share reading recommendations, what she calls under-the-radar books. So let's start with a history here. America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation, but it is not solely about combat of the Civil War.
In fact, I think that David Goldfield's book, it's light on combat and big on context and nuance. His feeling is that the Civil War, that there didn't need to be a war to solve the problem of slavery and the Union. Mm-hmm. What he felt drove the nation to war was the sort of exponential growth in both the North and the South of evangelical Christianity. And I have to say, this is a book that made me really look back at my assumptions and my beliefs, the kind of received knowledge that you get when you're a kid, and start reassessing them. Because the book is set over 1834 to 1876, basically.
Much wider frame than just the 4 years of the war, right?
Hugely. And he talks about all different aspects of society, the building of the railroads, the treatment of the American Indians, the gold rush. I thought that was a fascinating part in the book, and shows what the effects of those years leading up to the war and the hectoring from the pulpits about good and evil. It seemed in many ways he could be talking about our society today.
Which is, of course, what happens with history books. People will write them, and they are about a pastime, but they're also a reflection of our own time. It's almost a conversation between eras.
It is, and I think that that's one of the reasons why there have been so many books about the Civil War, say, because each time we reinterpret that war out of our own sensibilities.
You have also sent us a fictional look at history here. Set in 1943, the novel is called Codename Verity.
Codename Verity is a novel written for teens, although I do think that adults would enjoy it as well. It's the story of two girls, Maddie and Julie. Maddie is British, Julie is Scottish, and their work for the government during World War II. The book opens up on a very suspenseful scene. Julie's been captured by the Nazis in occupied France, and she agrees to confess everything that she knows about the British war effort. Hmm. I don't want to say anything else about the book, because I think that I just want other people to meet the novel without any preconceptions.
Well, you know, when you say World War II novel, you get a particular story in your head. It's something that's been written about so much and shown on the screen so much that I'm sure one of the challenges for any writer at the beginning of a project like that is to ask, what can I add that will not seem like it's already been done?
And one of the things that Elizabeth Wine added to this book, or the reason she wrote this book, was really to explore the role of young women in the British war effort. And it's a subject that we don't see a lot of fiction about at all for teens. And to have such a wonderful example of that here with Codename Verity is just very splendid.
Well, let's move from World War II to the post-war era, the Cold War, because there's a novel here called The Double Game.
The Double Game by Dan Fesperman is one of those books that will especially appeal to anyone who loves spy novels, as I do. The main character in this book is a man, now middle-aged man, but when he was a young cub reporter starting out, he was interviewing a man named Edwin Lemaster, who was one of the top spies during the Cold War. And in that conversation, he reveals to Bill that he had thought of going over to the Russians and becoming a double agent. Now, fast forward 20 years, he gets an anonymous note one day saying to him, "You didn't investigate what Lemaster said thoroughly enough." One of the best parts of this book is that many of the clues, some of the plot points, are physically found within various spy novels.
Wait a minute. You find some of the clues, or rather inside the book, some of the clues are found within books that are lying around.
Or they're on pages that have been torn out from these classic spy novels.
You love books about books, books that feature books, I think.
I do. I do. And I especially appreciate it when, as Dan Vesperman did at the end of this book, there's a pages-long bibliography of what he regards as the best spy novels ever.
You have also sent us a novel called Heft by Liz Moore. What is it?
Liz Moore's novel, Heft, is one of those books that is just perfect for people who love character-driven fiction. And it's the story of two people who are lonely and feeling isolated. One is literally isolated, and that's Arthur Opp, who was once a literature professor at a kind of community college in New York. Now he's 58. He's a recluse weighing 550 pounds. He's living in the house where he grew up. The other main character is a young man, a teenager named Kel Keller, who's handsome and popular, and he's an extremely talented high school baseball player who really wants to make it to the bigs. Their connection is slowly revealed through the novel, so that it's one of those books where you really get to know the characters so well that when you're finished with the book, you feel bereft of their company.
I'm reminded of a colleague years ago who said of a novel that she loved, "I slowed down reading it because I didn't want it to end."
Yes, and I think that Heft is one of the, well, I have to say, I think most of these books that I'm talking about today had that quality for me.
Nancy Pearl, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure, Steve.
She's the author of Book Lust to Go and a regular guest on this program. And you can find a list of all of Nancy's Under the Radar reads at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
E-commerce has been a challenge to the traditional bookselling business in recent years, but as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, bookstores can still depend on holiday shoppers to go for that reliable old technology, print on paper.
Steve Berkew has been in the book business for 40 years. His store, Book People, in Austin, Texas, has survived the threat of big chains, the competition from Amazon, and now is weathering the popularity of e-books. These days, Berkew says, bookstores that are still standing have a loyal following.
People choose to come to this store to do their Christmas shopping on a regular basis. It's a place you can bring your family. It does not have the overwhelming intensity of a shopping mall. It's a single store, and it's just part of the season here in Austin.
The holidays, says Berkew, are definitely the season for hardcovers. Any other time of the year, you might settle for a paperback or prefer the convenience of an e-book. But at this time of year, customers are looking for something special, for someone special. That novel that won an award, the biography everyone is talking about, those glossy coffee table books filled with beautiful photos and artwork.
Anything that anyone has ever thought of as a coffee table book pretty much only works as a coffee table book. I can't imagine anybody's going to put their any kind of e-reader on the coffee table and hope people look at it.
Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee agrees that e-books are no threat to that Christmas present standby. But Golden says art and photography books aren't doing that well at his store this year. This holiday season, Golden says, cookbooks are the new coffee table book.
And I don't mean cheap cookbooks. I mean the equivalent price point of a book at $60, say, that we can't really do well with an art book. But for a cookbook, we can really sell it well. And we know that people aren't particularly cooking out of those books. So it's the equivalent experience. It's people buy the book to show off the book, to enjoy the book, maybe to make something.
Golden does think that some hardcover books require a harder sell. Customers have to be persuaded that a physical book has a value that can't be found in an e-book.
I think the key is to convince them that this is one that's a keeper. And we'll make a case for that. We'll kind of have a customer weigh a book, like put it in their hands and say, look at the quality of this paper. That book won't be yellowed and it won't be brittle. That book will look great in 10, 20 years.
I think the smarter publishers are realizing that the way that the physical book matters is in the design of it.
Jessica Stockton Bagnulo of the Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn. She says her store has started a first editions club for customers who want to build their own collection of books that will last.
It works a little like a wine of the month or a chocolate of the month club. You sign up for a 6-month or a 12-month subscription, and then the booksellers at Greenlight will select new titles, fiction or nonfiction, that they think are great and might be valuable in the long term, and subscribers get a first edition of that book signed by the author.
But booksellers aren't taking any chances. They know lots of people have an e-reader on their Christmas list, so hundreds of independent bookstores have signed up to sell Kobo e-readers and e-books this Christmas, right along with all those hardcovers. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
All right, for the most part, we do not think mental illness and then think cartoons. But for cartoonist Ellen Forney, the two came crashing together just before her 30th birthday.
That's when she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. That diagnosis suddenly explained her supercharged highs and debilitating lows, and it's now the subject of Forney's graphic memoir, something like a graphic novel, but here, all true. It's titled Marbles, as in losing one's marbles, a hint that this memoir is both painful and funny. It opens just after a wild trip to a tattoo parlor leads Forney to a psychiatrist.
The psychiatrist was the one, after the second visit, told me that I was bipolar. And I didn't believe it briefly. We went through the symptoms together in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, basically the Bible of mental disorders. And when we went through the symptoms one by one, and it sank in. And it was just a very, very strange feeling to see what I had thought of, in particular when I was manic, as super duper me, exponentially me, very, very, very me, and to see it right there in a book.
Yeah, as a collection of symptoms.
Right, exactly.
And one of the first things you did was you found a list of some very famous writers and artists in history who had suffered from manic depressive illness or just depression. And at that moment in time, as you describe it, you got a membership card in what you call Club Van Gogh.
Yeah, I think that Van Gogh is really the ultimate crazy artist that we all think of. And so there was a certain sense of cred to being part of that lineage. I found that list both encouraging, and I felt like I had company. And at the same time, it was terrifying because all of these artists and writers who had done such brilliant work hadn't been medicated for the most part.
You have this fear or this notion that by treating your condition, you just might be medicating away your own creativity.
Well, for me, I don't think this is a spoiler for the book, but I find that stability is good for my creativity. There are different artists that I found that feel differently. Poet Anne Sexton was one. It was her opinion that it was the responsibility of artists to feel intense pain so that we could express that for other people who couldn't express it themselves. But then, of course, she committed suicide as well. So if you're talking about how creative someone with a mood disorder can be, that really cuts short your creativity and productivity if you cut your own life short.
You know, the words and the pictures entwine in this graphic memoir, a little like a dance. It really seems like you could never have told the story in any other way than this. There's one cartoon in the book where you are being literally swept into mania. That is, you're a little character in a little boat. Can you describe it for us?
Sure. On the left side of the page, there's this sense of what stability is about. There's a house and a dock, and then swooping over onto the right side of the page is me desperately reaching for the dock with the rope that had secured me there broken, and knowing that I was swept into this depiction that I did of mania, which is this big cloud of mermaids and hearts and stars and swirls and whoosh. And I could feel that I was slipping, that I was becoming unmoored, and there was really nothing that I could do to keep that from happening.
Well, you would think that most of this book on both the manic and the depression moments might be hard to be part of, hard to read. But in fact, there's quite a bit of joy and humor in this book.
It was very important to have humor in the book. For one, it's much easier to take in a difficult story if there's relief. There's a relief in being able to laugh. Like, for instance, in the book, there's a scene where, because of my health insurance that didn't cover mental health, I had to go to the cheapest place for my meds that I could find, and that was Costco. And so I would, very depressed, have to drag myself down to this huge, brightly lit, full of enormous tubs of peanut butter and Twizzlers, and I would go to the pharmacy there. And they did this thing at the time that I hope they don't do anymore, which is, with all of the rest of the people around, they call your name, your full name, Ellen Forney, and to make sure that they have the right prescription, they say, lithium. And so that kind of thing, maybe it wasn't funny at the time, and I would have to say it was not funny at the time. In retrospect, just the absurdity of it, very cool. Funny.
Well, I'm looking at the frame, and besides, here's your lithium, Miss Forney. There's a little sign above your head that says, like a blinking on and off sign saying, crazy.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's what I was trying to balance in this book, to give a sense of what it was like at the time. I was feeling so lost in the beginning, and I had no idea if things were going to be okay. And now at this point, I know, looking back, that they are.
Cartoonist Ellen Forney, her new graphic memoir is called Marbles. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee, so much for having me.
And you can see some of the cartoons from Forney's graphic memoir at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News with Renee Montagne. I'm Steve Inske.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. William Stuyvesant was one of the most flamboyant literary figures of the 20th century, a Southerner who first received acclaim at just 26. He'd go on to write The Confessions of Nat Turner, which earned him the Pulitzer Prize. For the last 27 years of his life, though, William Stuyvesant didn't write another novel. He battled depression. From that experience, he wrote a seminal work in 1990 called Darkness Visible. Now, 6 years after his death, his wife, Rose Stuyvesant, and co-editor R. Blakeslee Gilpin have compiled over 1,000 letters spanning Stuyvesant's life. The collection is called Selected Letters of William Stuyvesant. Welcome to the program, Rose.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This had to be something between a labor of love and, I don't know, maybe a real work of frustration. Why'd you decide to do it?
Because so few people write letters anymore, myself included, and there was such an incredible trove of letters to Bill that I found squashed in drawers in his study when I was putting the house in Connecticut we've lived in for 50 years on the market. I thought there must be troves of letters from him to these same friends and other friends, and I wanted to save them.
And there are letters in here to James Jones, to James Baldwin, to John Marcond, to Norman Mailer, Mia Farrow. I get the idea that at your table, whether in Roxbury, Connecticut, or on Martha's Vineyard, the two of you really knew many, many of the literary artists of our age.
I think that's true. We were incredibly lucky and had close friendships when we were young and everybody else was young, and many of our friends became pretty well known as artists of one kind or another.
You call these letters a secret life. As you're collecting them, what's coming back to you? What did you mean by that, a secret life?
I meant that Bill and I had both a private and public life, and then Bill had a sub-life that I found in his letters. He secretly felt a great many things that he did not say aloud, and he wrote them to special friends. And he allowed his sense of humor a lot of free play. His brilliant words took a lot of interesting turns they might not have in our daily life. But mainly, I had no idea how much he had observed and recorded of our life together. It was a revelation and really almost a piece of literature in itself. As I read it, it was like a novel.
Let's pick one to read. You've got some great ones here. I was kind of looking at the one from page 374 to his mentor, William Blackburn.
William Blackburn was Bill's favorite professor, and he wrote many, many letters to Blackburn from the time he arrived at Duke until Blackburn died. And this is from 1966. Quite frankly, I feel that the publication of personal letters, as distinct from public letters, correspondence to newspapers, etc., while the writer is still alive, has somewhat the quality of gratuitous exposure. To be honest, when I read that letter of mine which you sent and thought of it appearing in print, I felt terribly naked all of a sudden. Certainly, as I say, the letter has nothing in its content to really embarrass me, an earnest youth worrying about his future, etc. Nonetheless, it was not written for public display, and since I'm still quite alive, or feel myself to be so from time to time, I would quite simply not want to see these very private meanderings in print. When a writer is dead, certainly that becomes a different matter. Presumably, then, there evolves enough interest in the writer's private self that the very publication of his correspondence wipes out the element of gratuitousness.
You know, that is so interesting. Do you think he had any hint that after his death you might do exactly what you... And I know you had a colleague here, Blakeslee Gilpin, what the two of you have done?
If so, I had no hint of it when he was alive. I had not a clue that he'd written thousands of letters. I thought he was upstairs working on his fiction all the time. And he expressed the feeling that one needed to write letters to stave off tedium or panic. But I don't think he had that kind of an eye for posterity.
The two of you are known for having a long, loving, but sometimes tempestuous marriage. Lots of things happen over the course of 53 years. How do you review your life with him now that these letters have come to light?
I think I see it as a reaffirmation of the wonderful marriage I remember. Wonderful marriages, of course, have ups and downs if they last for a half century. The love and understanding and conviction that I was married to a good, tender, caring man who might fly off the handle frequently at me and everybody else was restored in the best way possible. And he had such an incredible memory, and he recorded everything. My memory's terrible and I recorded nothing, that I was given a whole new picture of our lives together that I really, really cherish.
I've been speaking with Rose Steiben, who, with the co-editor, has compiled a collection of her late husband's letters called The Selected Letters of William Steiben. Rose Steiben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Growing up blonde and blue-eyed in Southern California, Joe Mazzingo thought his name was Italian, but the family history on his father's side had always been a bit of a mystery. On the journey to discover the truth about the Mazzingo name, Joe travels from the libraries of Los Angeles to the courthouses and plantations of Virginia, and finally to Angola. Along the way, he learns about 300 years of Mazzingos, from abolitionists to members of the KKK. Joe Mazzingo joined us from NPR West to tell us how the journey began and the book he's written about it called The Fiddler on Pantico Run.
I always had kind of a longing to understand the history of the place I lived in, and I think that came from the fact that I had no family history that I knew of. And then when people started asking me my name, as you mentioned, I kept wondering, how is it that we don't actually know where this name came from?
So it's somewhere around the time that you go to journalism school that you make a connection, sort of your aha moment, if you will.
And I met a professor who was Sherry Mazzingo, and she was black. And she had done a lot more research than I had on her genealogy and had been to a family reunion in North Carolina and came back with news that the name was African, and that we all descended from the same person, and he was, in her words, a Bantu warrior. My uncle, out of nowhere, said we did in fact come from Virginia, where this slave had landed. There was this period in Virginia that I'd never known about, where free blacks and poor whites were mixing and getting married even.
So let's go back to this ancestor, whose name is Edward Mazzingo. He's abducted from, you think at the time, Cameroon, later on you think Angola. He's only a child, and tell us what happens.
We think he landed in when he was about 11 years old near Jamestown, and basically when these Africans arrived, they figured they wouldn't live more than a couple of years. There was no reason to have a lifelong slave, so they treated them as indentured servants. So Edward appears to have had a contract with his master to work a certain amount of time.
This is fascinating. You are actually able to trace Edward Mazzingo's freedom papers, if you will, to 1672 in Virginia.
It's a complete miracle that that paper survived. The records surrounding it were burned in the courthouse in Williamsburg, and then they were trucked to a courthouse in Richmond, which burned during the Civil War. His volume just happened to be gone the day that the Richmond courthouse burned, but was lost, presumably for good, until it turned up in the Virginia Historical Society in a pile of mutilated, tattered documents. But there it was, this one intact page with his ruling.
He turns up at the courthouse in Jamestown. I think it's October the 5th, 1672.
Yeah. And I went to that courthouse and saw the exact spot he would have walked out when he got his freedom, looking up the James River as it kind of winds up into America. I mean, it's a beautiful spot.
And then he seems to have become relatively prosperous for the day. He's a tradesman. He marries a white woman.
He marries a white woman who doesn't even seem to be particularly poor, even.
You stumble across many people with the name Mazzingo in this book. And there in Virginia, you meet a character, Junior Mazzingo. A lot of these people didn't really want to think about having an African ancestor.
He didn't want to hear about it at all. I mean, he had lived literally on the spot where Edward Mazzingo had lived 300 years before, yet he had this myth that they were Italian and they had gotten here in the 1800s, when in fact you could trace his lineage straight to Edward. Edward is his seventh great-grandfather.
And you handled that in a pretty gingerly way.
I did. My initial intention was to go there and make people's heads explode with the news that they were black, even though they weren't. But, you know, someone invites you into their house, they're very nice, and you realize this guy lived a very hard life.
When does the line sort of bend? When is his family crossing the color line?
There was this brief period where Edward did well, and then the rich class has really wanted to put the squeeze on the poor to create the system of slavery, which really marginalized the poor whites and the free people of color. Their fates went downhill really fast. They were suddenly out of money. One of them re-indentured himself to, you know, pay off some debt. They basically started leaving the area, and that was the time they could reinvent themselves. Those that were light-skinned enough could say they were white, and wherever they landed, they came up with a new myth. You know, people said they were French Huguenot, Portuguese.
Anything but African.
Anything but African, exactly.
In the second half of this book, you actually decide that you must go to Africa, and you meet another Mazingo, and his name is Victor Masinga, and he's a very famous playwright. What does he tell you?
He starts telling me a story, how his grandfather landed in jail. The day he got out of jail, his son was born, and they named his son Masinga, and he said that Masinga is a thread or a linking of people, which just blew my mind because that was what I was trying to do with this whole book, draw this link from Edward Masinga in Africa all the way across the Atlantic to me in California and just through the people along the way.
Yeah, I kind of got chills when I saw that. The closing scene of your book, you're at your cousin's wedding in Virginia Beach. She's a white woman. She's marrying a black man. And it's a bit heartbreaking. Her father refuses to attend because it's an interracial marriage.
It's hard to believe that people can't get past these things. You know, when her grandfather came up to me when I first met him, went on and on about how she was his favorite granddaughter, how much he loved her, how proud of her he was. And when he found this out, he just went ballistic and fell into a deep depression and subsequently had a lot of health problems.
I gather that branch of your family hasn't been coming to book readings.
No. Well, some of them have. I mean, she who got married, I mean, we're friends.
That's Joe Masinga. His new book out is called The Fiddler on Pantico Run. Joe, thank you so much. It's really fascinating.
Thank you.